Gentlemen, I would like first to call your attention to next week's luncheon meeting at which Dr. Arthur Coons of Occidental College will talk on the proposed master plan for California higher education. Today, we are to hear a man who has addressed the Commonwealth Club three times previously, and his popularity is certainly attested by the size of the audience that has come here today. In each of these talks, he has been concerned with our nation's international posture, with the problems of foreign aid, and particularly on the last occasion, with the United States' position in regard to the Soviet Russia Union. That last appearance was 4 years ago, almost to a day. Today, Governor Harriman will bring up to date his thoughts concerning our relationship with Russia, a subject that has had an unusually close and important part of his experience. As you know, he has recently revisited Russia. Early in World War II, Governor Harriman was special representative of the President in the United Union with the rank of ambassador as chairman of the United States Commission. Later, he became the United States ambassador to Russia, a position he held from 1953 to 1943 to 1946. After a brief period as ambassador to the court of St. James, he became Secretary of Commerce. Then for 3 years, he was the United States representative in Europe in connection with the Marshall Plan. Later, as you all know, he was elected governor of New York. It is interesting that the topic that he will discuss with us today, peace with Russia, is also the title of a book that he has recently put out, the only difference in the title being that in the book title he has a question mark after peace with Russia. It is with great pleasure that I present to you today the Honorable Averill Harriman.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Commonwealth Club and my friends, I don't know how many men have had the distinction of speaking to your distinguished club four times, but I consider it a very, very high honor. And I'm certainly very glad to be able to be with you again and to talk about some of the problems which are vitally affecting the lives of all of us. My knowledge of San Francisco goes back quite far. The first time I came here, I think, was at the turn of the century. I can't claim to be a native son, but I think perhaps I've been here before many of you young men, I see. We're in San Francisco because I think in 1901 I came with my father and have watched this great city and great state grow ever since. It's been stimulating to me. Unfortunately, you remember that my father was concerned with the Union Pacific and Southern Pacific, and Teddy Roosevelt took upon himself to create a divorce. I thought it was the job of the president to get amity in the families, but in any event, he decided that the Union Pacific and Southern Pacific should be divorced, and so it happened. It was my misfortune, because having grown up that railroad, I didn't have as much business here in San Francisco, but indirectly, of course, we have. Maybe it was some disadvantage to San Francisco. The Union Pacific didn't have its own rails into this city. But as I'm no longer an officer of the Union Pacific, why, I'm entitled perhaps to give it a little plug. As your chairman, Coke, has said, I was in the Soviet Union last spring. I returned the first time I'd been back since I'd been ambassador. I've been studying Russia ever since the revolution, went there, had business in Russia in the middle 20s, talks with Trotsky and the leaders at that time, and naturally have followed it ever since. I was ambassador. I got a number of notions about what was going on. The reports I had from my friends who'd been there, what I'd read, seemed to be quite conflicting. And so I wanted to get some answers to the questions of what had happened. And the book that your chairman has so kindly mentioned, which I've written, which I hope I can induce you to read, because I wrote it not for profit, but to hope that you would read it, many of you, is a description of the changes that have taken place and my size up of the answers to my own questions. Now, the first of those questions, which was the $64,000... Oh, I don't suppose it's quite right to use that expression anymore. Let's be modest and say $64 question. Is whether Khrushchev and his associates at the Kremlin had become somewhat soft, more concerned with Russia for the Russians and less concerned with Russia as a base for communist world revolution. Now, I came to the unhappy conclusion, unfortunate conclusion, that Mr. Khrushchev and the present generation of Kremlin leaders were just as determined to spread world revolution as was Stalin. Russia is as a base. It's the growth of strength of Russia, even the improvement of standard of living of the people, to show the success of communism. Now, there's a wide change in life in the Soviet Union, and the methods of the two men are different. Perhaps one of the most important has been the change in the use of terror. Stalin ruled by fear. He was an absolute dictator. Consulted, of course, his associates, but his decision was law, and he enforced his decisions by the use of the secret police. He feared the people, and the people feared him. And that is really was part of historic Russia, which would go back to the old days of the Tsars. Now, perhaps I can tell you best in Mr. Khrushchev's own words. I had some long talks with him when I was in Moscow last June. And the question of Stalin came up. He knew that I had dealt with Stalin perhaps more than any Western diplomat during the war, that I had respect for his abilities, recognized the leadership that he gave to his people and to the Allied cause during the war, and so he talked quite intimately about Stalin. He said Stalin had changed. In the last years of his life, he'd become more and more autocratic, more and more suspicious. And in fact, he said that when he went to see Stalin, and that was true of the other members of the Politburo, they never knew where they would ever see their families again. Now, that made me stop to think. There could be such a relationship between and the ruling men of the nation, that they never knew where they would be picked up for something that had been alleged to be done, a change of policy which made it convenient for Stalin to accuse them of disloyalty, saboteurs or whatever it might be. They might be convicted after trial, shot, or sent to Siberia with dozens of others who may have been associated with them in their offices. They were determined to change that, as Khrushchev said, and to have a sense of security themselves. And after they killed Beria, who was not willing to conform, by the secret police was demoted. And I noticed in the press yesterday that indicated there was a still further change, an abolition of the Department of the Interior, which was, of course, the commissariat of the secret police, had been disorganized still further. Now, this has meant a change in the life of the people. When you go to Russia today, the people are the street are ready to talk to you in the parks. They're not too ready to take you to their homes because they're somewhat ashamed of the manner in which they live. They're a little afraid to come to the hotels. But there isn't the same sense of fear, and the knock on the door at midnight no longer exists, where men were pulled out for some alleged crime, such as having worked in the same office with a man who was under suspicion. But at the same time, there is a very stern discipline. And take in labor. I went to one of the trials, which was the new extrajudicial courts they've established. They call them the comradely courts. And the man who was being held up on charges was a man who had done the terrible thing of missing one shift without having a doctor's certificate explaining the reason for his not doing it, illness. Now that, he was let off, but with the admonition that if it ever occurred again, why, there would be some serious penalty. The penalties would be docking of salaries, demotion to a less important job, or even being sent out of, this happened to be in Leningrad, to some other city. Now that comes very close to enforced labor. On the other hand, I must say that the men, the working people in Russia are working hard because they are induced to do so by incentives. And the incentive system is developed more and more in the Soviet Union. It's something that we should give some consideration to, because as many of our methods are becoming more egalitarian, you will find that the Soviet Union in all aspects of their life are giving incentives in a different system. Of course, then we have, the government decides what should be the best paid. I'm always interested in telling my university friends that the scientists and the college, the university professors get the highest pay. I don't find any criticism of that conception. I hope some of you may be here from the academic world. I think there's a good deal to be said for that conception. I also amuses me to tell some of my business friends that the pay of the average factory manager, the manager of a business, may be about the same as a ballet dancer. Very considerably degrees below that of the more intellectual pursuits. I don't find agreement with my business friends as to that necessarily, that being the method of the more accurate method of reward in terms of the contribution to the life of our country. Partly I am naturally being joking about this. But it is interesting that they have adopted the incentive system, and they're quite boastful about it. Of course, they're going through this period, they say, of socialism, and eventually they'll come to pure communism when men are sufficiently educated to recognize that their obligation to society is such that they don't want any material rewards. But they recognize they're quite a long ways from that. And although they have succeeded, and it's quite a change from the earlier Russia that I know, getting the acceptance of the regime, or at least the acquiescence in it, as against to the concept which many people had when I first went there in 1936, that this regime might be thrown out. I don't find any justification for some of the statements of our high officials that the Kremlin is living on a powder keg, or that the whole rotten structure is going to collapse. It is a firm and strong structure, and although there is a lot of gripes, a lot of concern over the fact they haven't got adequate apartments to live in, and the girls want to have prettier clothes, they want more shoes, and they want more meat, they want refrigerators, and of course in some distant future the ambition of all the Russians is the same as an American, they want an automobile. Now, there are many other aspects of Soviet life which I haven't got time to go into, but in case you are interested to pursue it further, I do mention the fact that that there is this book, which is available at the stores. I don't make a great fortune out of it, so that I'm more interested in having such information as it brings disseminated. I think of all the things that are important in our relations with Russia is an understanding of Russia on the part of the American people. And there's so many misconceptions that it is makes it rather dangerous, I think, in dealing with the affairs that have to have public support. Now, we see, of course, a tremendous development of science, and we cannot help but have great respect for their scientific development. And not only outer space exploration, but in the development of their weapons of war. Those are somewhat terrifying. We don't know what the new proposals of Mr. New Weapon that Mr. Khrushchev speaks about, but this, you can be sure that there's no unilateral disarmament involved in his proposal to reduce his air force and his army. This is a new strategic concept of their military establishment. And I hope it will not lead to relaxation in our own country or in our, among our European friends. It behooves us, I think, very much to recognize that they are ahead of us in these fields and that we should catch up with them. Now, Khrushchev gave me the very definite impression that he wanted to curtail his military expenditures. And you may ask me, was I taken in by it? I've got to confess that Mr. Khrushchev is a consummate actor, as you saw, those of you who were here, who saw him perform. But if you're with a man long enough, you get certain impressions. And perhaps I can tell you one story, which some of you may think has a political connotation, but I'm only acting as a reporter. We got on the subject of the American elections, and I gave him my honest opinion. I said I didn't know who the individual would be, who'd be the next president of the United States, but I was quite satisfied it would be a Democrat. I don't believe that would receive unanimous approval in this group. or unanimous acceptance, at least until after election. But in any event, he said, there's no difference between the two parties. They're both capitalists, and I can see no difference between them. And I said, Mr. Khrushchev, there is a very considerable difference between them. And he said, well, name one. And I said, well, the Democrats will be more concerned, and are more concerned, about the security of our nation than in balancing the budget at a particular level. And he has a little fat finger, you know, those of you who saw him, and he shook at my face, and he said, does that mean you're going to spend more money? And I said, that's exactly what it means. And then he said, the tone in which he said it, well, then I'll have to spend more money, made me recognize that it was not something that he wanted to do. And I said, no, that doesn't mean you'll have to spend more money, but you'll have to pay more attention to the conditions that we place on arms limitation. Because unless you are ready to give the kind of inspection and controls that President Eisenhower is demanding, you're not going to get any agreement on disarmament. But now, if that story leads any of you to vote for the Democratic candidate for the presidency, it's not my fault. I'm only acting as a reporter. But it's going to be a tough proposition, and we're going to have long arguments about it. And it's interesting, we went on to discuss the question of inspection, and he has the conviction that we're trying to spy on him. He recognizes that their secrecy is a great asset, and it is a great asset, because during the war at Stalingrad, Stalin brought in some divisions, some well-trained divisions from Siberia, and attacked the Germans, you remember, at the north, and cut off and Paulus, and if they had been well-informed, I doubt whether that would have been successful. I doubt very much whether they would have been successful to get ahead of us in the Sputnik if we'd known all of the scientific work that they'd been doing and perhaps the experiments they'd tried which had failed. Now, he is rather derogatory of President Eisenhower's open sky policy, which we all thought was fine, because he said, I know everything that's going on in the United States. All I have to do is to read your publications, and I'm well informed. You, however, would learn. So that's something to ponder about, because that is an aspect which we're going to have to deal with. And I told him he was going to have to give up his secrecy if he wanted to come to a understanding with us on arms limitation, which I certainly hope will be one of the steps which will be taken in the meeting at the summit. Now, running quickly to other subjects, as we must keep within our time, I believe that we've come to a moment when we can seize the initiative again. There's a lot of general talk, particularly in political talk, about our taking the initiative. Why do we let the Russians have the initiative? There have been periods when we've been able to take the initiative. Now, after the war, Stalin was quite determined to take over Western Europe. He saw the dislocations which had occurred. He knew the economic conditions which existed, and he thought that democratic or capitalistic methods would not be able to achieve the recovery in Europe rapidly enough, and the communist parties would be able to take over at least France and Italy, and that the whole Western Europe would fall under his domination. Well, that might well have happened if it hadn't been for the Marshall Plan and the initiative that we took at that time, which you all are thoroughly familiar with, and I will not now belabor. Khrushchev today has the same conception as Stalin did. He thinks that the conditions in the underdeveloped countries where there is a demand, the part of the people to throw off the misery and hunger and poverty that exists in those countries, that cannot be achieved through a democratic process, that only through the communistic dictatorship can it be achieved. And he's very proud of the results that he has achieved in the Soviet Union. You know, Stalin thought that, and told me so, that communism would develop in the cesspools of capitalism, as he said, whereas Khrushchev says we are making such a tremendous success of communism that other countries are going to have to follow. Now, he believes that the success of communism in Russia and also in Red China will induce other countries to follow that example because of the failure which he believes will occur in these other countries. Now, I think this gives us a great opportunity to seize the initiative again. Unfortunately, as a dividend from the Marshall Plan, we have allies in Europe who are stronger than any of us had fondest expectations and are able to support and work with us. And the same is true of Japan. The industrial countries of the world can join with us. There must be a great cooperative movement among the industrial countries in cooperation with the industrial countries and perhaps on a regional basis, working through the United Nations or directly on a regional basis with the different areas of the world, Asia, Africa, Latin America, and develop an adequate program. Now, you businessmen know that the surest way to lose money is to have inadequate capital for any development. That almost assures failure. The great success of the Marshall Plan was due to the fact that it was adequately financed. Now, we can keep these countries on their present level of poverty more or less indefinitely by dribbling money out year by year. It's self-defeating. It is not adequate to the situation. Now, just to give you some idea of the order of dimensions, the best guesstimates, which I think are available, at least they've been made by some people, are that the underdeveloped countries are today receiving about $5 billion a year from all sources. That's private capital, from other governments, Russia included, from the World Bank, Colombo Plan, and our own development funds, and surplus foods, and so forth. Now, the best estimate is that about $3 billion more will go a long ways towards making it possible for many of these countries to break through. Some of them are more advanced than others, but the more advanced countries, such as India, break through the cycle of poverty into a cycle of self-generating expansion and development, by which they, after a certain number of years, India believes that at the end of their third five-year plan, they will be able to handle the future expansion under their own resources with the normal channels of finance. Now, India is a case in point, and I'll dwell on that a moment, because I went to India last year. It is, in a sense, a key, not only geographically between Southeast Asia and Africa, but also is a key in the sense that if you go to the Far East, you'll find people say there's a great test going on between the success of Red China in improving the conditions of the people and industrializing the country and India. Now, the Indian government has a competent group of civil servants, which they inherited from the British. They have transportation, they have certain basic industries and ports and so forth, and they're moving ahead in a very sensible, rather a sensible way. They have prejudices to get over in the villages, which are very backward, and there's a great educational job that must be done, but they have a competent administration. And they will need, as I believe they've correctly been estimated, somewhere between $800 and $1 billion a year. They may be getting about $500 million today. It's not a vast increase. When you think that $1 billion a year is only $2.50 per capita, their standard of living is pathetically low. $60 a year, perhaps, as compared to our $2,000. Unfortunately, the rich countries are getting richer relatively, and the poor countries. In the last 10 years, the United Nations have estimated that our standard per capita income has gone up $500 a year. The other industrial countries about $300 a year. and the underdeveloped countries about $20. On the average, I think, from about $110 to $130 per capita. Now, the Indians want to get up to the average of the underdeveloped countries as rapidly as possible. And they believe they can do it with outside assistance. They don't want handouts. They are ready to take loans, but of course many of the loans will have to be slow loans, soft loans, and private currency, and our own food can be of enormous value to them until such time as their program for self-sufficiency of food food develops. Now, these are the people of the world responded to the leadership which was given in 1947 at the time of the Marshall Plan, the support, the leadership not only of President Truman, but also of Senator Vandenberg, a Republican of Michigan, are of great importance in supporting the program, and the people of the United States responded. And I think there's no doubt in my mind that if we have a program that people can see, as I go around the country, there is complacency, yes, but back of it is deep concern, and they will follow a program which sees some end to it and has some objective which is attainable and which will tend to achieve the purposes that we want to achieve. Now, these things are important to do not because we are undertaking the competition which Mr. Khrushchev throws at us, but it is very much to our interest to do it anyway, regardless of communism. It's impossible to think that two-thirds of the people of the free world can be living at $100 a year income as against our 2,000. In addition to which, as you all know, you businessmen all know that as countries have developed their industrial capacity, there's been an increase in trade between them. You know what's happened to Canada since she's become industrialized, and the same thing is true with the European countries. So that there's every opportunity on our part to achieve very, very important results for our own prosperity, but most of all for our own security and holding the frontiers of freedom against attack. Now, I would certainly do as much as possible on a multilateral basis, because it is not undignified for a country to accept the decisions of an international organization that has been proved by the extremely competent way in which Eugene Black, who many of you know, has operated the World Bank, whereas there is great resentment for conditions being established on the part of one country as against another. I would certainly ask the Russians in, as we did in the Marshall Plan. I doubt if they would come in, but even if they did, it would be a good thing. If they didn't come in, why then their imperialist motives would be exposed. How is do you know what the time is? How much time is left? About 3 minutes. I want to say we can't expect on a per capita basis as much help from the European countries as some people seem to indicate, because their standard of living is very much below ours. Britain is about 50%, Germany about 40%, and Japan, as many of you know, is less than 15%. In terms of what they have, it's interesting that in automobiles, the last figures were 57. We had, I think, 328 per thousand. Britain had 82, I think, and Germany about 50. And the same is true in connection with television sets and refrigerators and otherwise. So that you can see, we cannot expect the same per capita assistance, but we can expect their assistance, and as time goes on, more and more. But it is very important that we get their cooperation, and I commend Douglas Dillon for his initiative in going and working with the OWC, the European organization, and I hope more will come out of it. But I think their sights are too low, and they're too timid in their approach. It isn't just to carry on what we're doing. Let's do the job adequately. And when we Americans have tackled the job, we've done it well. Where we've failed, it's when we have not faced up to what the real problems are. Now, Khrushchev today has indicated that he doesn't want war, and I think he's right in that. I think he's sincere in that. He doesn't want to destroy what has been built up. The standard of living in Russia is pathetically low compared to ours, but it is increasing, and he wants to increase it. And he has gone home, acted more as a politician. He's promised, he said he bragged about the fact he was a great success over here. And he's told them as a result of his activities there's a greater chance for peace. So one of his slogans, political slogans, is peace. And he has another slogan in which he has said, we're going to give you more consumer goods. So in a sense, he's giving them the other slogan, prosperity. Now, some of you may have heard of this slogan, peace and prosperity. And anyone who wants to adopt that slogan in the coming campaign can recognize that they have a very good example in Mr. Khrushchev and can follow in his steps and can use his slogan. But the interesting thing is that he believes that he has to get the support of his people today. He can't do as Stalin did, use terror. He's got to get the support of his people. And in addition to that, he has to, of course, get the support of the Communist Party, because it is the Central Committee of the Communist Party that is the dominating factor. And if he got his power that way, then he must keep control of it. Now, in closing, and there's so much more that I would like to say, but I just want to say this, that talking about Mr. Khrushchev's peace, I think any politician wants to use that phrase or to use it with great care, because the peaceful coexistence that he suggests is not the kind of peace we want. It isn't amity and goodwill among nations, goodwill working for the welfare of humanity. It is, at the same moment he talks about that, he says that we're on the way out, that he's going to bury us, at least in the historic sense, and he's going to do it and take any means that he can to achieve that objective, possibly with military threats in the background. He'll want to avoid war, of course. And so what he proposes is, in fact, all-out competitive coexistence. And it's let's understand that it's competition for our survival and freedom. And so, we believe in competition. Let's accept that challenge. And let's deal with it in a vigorous manner and deal with it in such a way that we can man the frontiers of freedom and use the great productive capacity of our country, which we've inherited, productive capacity such as no nation has ever dreamed of before, and above all else, the great political principles and traditions of freedom, which is our greatest of all heritage. If we will use those resources, particularly the resource of our heritage and freedom, there can be no doubt in my mind as to the outcome, because in freedom, the initiative of the individual will play such an important part, and no totalitarian government can ever mobilize such human energies and human resources.
Governor, I think that in order to keep you out of trouble and myself, I ought to say that my reference to your new book, Peace with Russia, is entirely a clean deal. I would like at this time to turn the Commonwealth Club meeting over to its president, Lloyd Grable, who will conduct the question and answer period.
Governor Harriman, if you will return to the lectern here with me, Governor, and if you return here, you and I can read the questions together. I'll read them out loud, and that will speed up the get more questions answered, I think. You didn't have quite enough time, I thought, to finish the beginning of your closing, if I may use those terms. And since we read the questions exactly as they come to us, do you feel that the current group of Soviet officials are more trustworthy than the batch you dealt with?
Well, a lot of people say you can't trust Khrushchev. I say that you can. When he tells you that he believes that communism is going to rule the world, it behooves us to believe in him. When he says that he thinks we're on the way out, it behooves us to believe in him. He was very patronizing with me when I had dinner with him. He patted me on the shoulder and he said, don't worry, the United States will be the last to succumb. You will be able to finish your life in ease and comfort. Now, I believe him when he says that. Now, but then when it comes to a point of whether I would believe him if he said, accept his proposal to outlaw the use of the atomic warhead on missiles, I would certainly not do it. I wouldn't believe him or anyone unless we had adequate inspection. I think we all ought to support President Eisenhower in the position that he's taken in that respect. But we can make agreements where they are enforceable, and it behooves us to try to come to understandings and negotiate with them. And I'm glad that President Eisenhower is pursuing that policy. I think he should be supported and applauded for it.
Would you say that the Soviet Union's recent industrial success is due more to Stalin's suppression of opposition or more to Khrushchev's success in deviating from classical communist doctrine?
Well, let me stop the end of that. I don't think Khrushchev's deviated from classical communist doctrine any more than Lenin did or any more than Stalin did. The basic plans were made by Stalin. When I saw him in 44, 45, he told me that their program was to have 60 million tons of steel. They then had about 12 million tons after the damage the Germans had done. And I thought that would be a long time, and I suggested it would be a long time. He said it will take 15 to 20 years. Well, it's interesting that 14 years after the war, last year they have 60 million tons of steel. Now, the plans that Stalin made were very well thought out. And anyone who studied what they've done is when they decide to do something, they have an opportunity through their dictatorial methods of using all of their brain power and their resources to achieve the objective. But I want to quickly say that just because they've done an amazing job in the exploration of outer space and expanding their heavy industry, and their quality of work is good in the building the steel mills. But as you see the brickwork in the steel mills with the blast furnaces and the coke ovens, extremely good. But you go 2 miles and find brickwork building apartments, which is pathetic. And the apartments they're building are, when they're opened up, they look 20 years old. The concrete chips from the steps, the lumber pulls away from the concrete slabs which they build their apartments from, and it's a very shoddy job. So that they aren't 8 feet high. They are able, however, to mobilize their resources. Now, directly answering this, I think Stalin's plans are the ones that are now being carried out. And, of course, Khrushchev has gotten a certain enthusiasm. Let's call it, I went to Yale, the Yale spirit idea. And some of you may think that was a misfortune, but I think it was a great privilege. Everyone who works in the Soviet Union knows what his share of the seven-year plan is. Makes you stop to think. In every factory, there is a target for what that seven-year program is in relation to what the job that factory should do this coming month. And that's true of each shop and each crew in each shop, so that they get rewards for achieving or going beyond their target, and they get also recognition, which is of importance to people. Now, Khrushchev is trying to give enthusiasm to the people in achieving these results, and he's getting a good deal of loyalty from the Russian people than Stalin ever got in achieving these results. Now, just because I am analytical, don't get anybody to give me the idea that I think this is good. I think this whole system of dictatorial communism is a terrible menace which faces us of the world and their atheist philosophy. But this fellow Khrushchev, don't underrate him. He's a very skillful leader.
Now, among some of the other questions bearing on the thought that you've been expressing, we no longer hear mention of Russian slave labor camps. Is it your understanding they still exist?
Well, I was asked where I wanted to go. The red carpet, deep plush carpet, was out for me, and I was permitted to go to places that no American had ever gone before. So I asked that I wanted to see some of the new slave, they didn't call them slave labor camps, prison labor camps, and they said, well, we don't anymore have them. And Mr. Khrushchev, evidently, was following the request I was making, because in a speech that he made a few days later, he said, Ambassador Hammond wants to go to these prison labor camps. We told him they don't exist anymore, for the very good reason that they weren't profitable. He said that the glorious free labor of the Soviet Union can produce much more at much less expense than the dishonorable, subversive prisoners who were in the camps. Now, I did go to a prison. It was a semi-secure prison, and I found it pretty well operated. I know something of prisons because I was governor of the state of New York once before I was thrown out. And I was rather impressed with the methods that they were using. Now, whether there are any slave labor camps left, I don't know. But I went to one of the dread areas, Karaganda, which were the dread coal mines, which were operated by political prisoners under awful conditions. were then operated by regular miners, and the camps where they were kept, the stockades were still there, but they were not being used anymore. So I didn't see any evidence of it, and there are a lot of evidence that they don't do it anymore. A political offense is a crime. They're dealt with as criminals, but I don't see the tens of thousands of people being sent to work camps that were the case under Stalin. But I can't go further than that in an answer.
Governor Harriman, is Russia's economic potential a greater threat to America than her military potential?
Well, I would not take any chances on the military side. I would be mighty sure. Now, one of the things I'm concerned about today is that we catch up in the missile program, make sure that there can be no doubt that if any aggression occurs, there will be a terrible cost to the Soviet Union as the aggressor. So that I can't say which is greater threat. I do believe that the determination of the Russians to communize the world is a very great threat, and it may be a generation or two from now. I hope someday there will be a softening within the Soviet Union. The present time there is more education you have, the greater demand there is for intellectual freedoms, and the more consumer goods they have, the more demand there is. So I see the beginnings of some Achilles' heels, if I can use that in the plural, and in some future date, not today, we may see a softening. Now, in the meantime, the economic threat is very great, because there's no doubt they are expanding their economy at a more rapid rate than we are, somewhere in the neighborhood of 7%, with the outlook somewhere around 6%. Ours, I think, is a matter of national policy. We ought to put first priority on growth, and of the other conditions we should deal with is deal with the inflation problem, which is very serious. But we shouldn't put inflation as the objective to achieve. It should be growth. And I think that is going to be one of the political issues in this campaign. I think that it'll be one which it behooves the American people and it behooves the businessmen to understand, because it is not wise for us to let the Soviet Union catch up with us in economically, which they will do if we continue such a low rate of growth as we have had all but last year and the last 8 years.
Governor Harriman.
And of course, may I say that they're going to use this economic strength in the underdeveloped countries, and unless we do make it possible for the underdeveloped countries to throw off the slavery of poverty, they will turn to the Soviet Union, and then it will be extremely difficult for us to get our raw materials, and we'll become more and more isolated from the world. Disastrous results.
Governor Harriman, one of the taxpayers in our audience, asks this question. When, if ever, will Russia repay her lend-lease indebtedness to us?
Well, I don't know. I'm glad to see Mr. Boland has taken that. I'm glad to see Mr. Boland is brought back from the Pacific and brought to Washington to deal with the Russian affairs. I understand he's going to start negotiations again. The sums involved are not very great. The difference is, we gave them something like $11 billion, and we're arguing about something between $300 and $800 million. I don't know what it is, but I'm inclined to think that sooner or later they're going to try to make a deal, because they are very keen to get on an economic basis with us. Every place I went in the Soviet Union, the factory manager had a delectable list, catalog, of American machine tools or American machinery of some kind that they wanted to buy to improve their situation, and they want to get this equipment from us. And therefore, I think there's considerable pressure to improve the trade relationship between us. Whether we want to improve that relationship is another matter.
There are two questions, Governor, if you could take 1 minute to, so that I could save the last minute for another question on local politics. Not national politics, I should say. These questions have to do with, I think, principally the approach of Russia and Soviet China, Red China. And the questions are involved are, do you believe that if the United States recognized Red China, it would help or hurt cooperation between Russia and Red China? And what is Khrushchev's attitude toward Red China's role in world communism?
Well, that is one of the questions I want to try to find out about. And my impression is, and I think I'm right, that we cannot It would be wishful thinking if we thought there would be, in the near future, a basic split between the Soviet Union and China. It may come in another generation, but each needs the other too greatly. China needs Russian technical assistance and machinery to expand her industry, which she's determined to do, and Russia needs Red China to help her in the expansion of world communism. Stalin never thought very much of Mao Zedong during the war. We discussed it many times. And Mao Zedong has always maintained not a position of satellite to the Soviet Union, but one of equality. And that is what is going to continue, in my opinion. And it's rather troublesome to the Kremlin because they prefer the other relationship. But today it may well be that Red China has more aggressive intentions than Khrushchev would like to have, because Khrushchev is trying to pose as the dove of peace, winging around the world. And it's rather disquieting to him to have these aggressive moves, I believe, that China make. It may be, of course, there's a wicked partner relationship which has been developed. So let Mr. Khrushchev come in as the peacemaker. It's very hard to say. But my own opinion is that there is a difference of attitude and point of view, and that Khrushchev wants Red China is more on the march today than Moscow. In any event, it would be, I believe, wishful thinking to think that anything that we did would lead to a break between the two countries, but we certainly should pursue a diplomatic policy over the years which would tend to make it easier for a break one way or another, whatever the situation may be in the future.
Now, the last question, Governor Harriman, is embodied in about 8 to 10 questions that came up from the 8 to 10 Democrats who are here today. I would be sure that were true, except there's only been one question on the Republican politics, and I'm sure there's more than one Republican here today. And in essence, since you have stated that the next president will be a Democrat, who will he be?
Well, I can't tell you that. I couldn't tell Khrushchev, and I don't know why I should why I shouldn't have been perfectly frank with Mr. Khrushchev. I can assure you that he'll be a man that you can have great satisfaction in voting for. He will be decided in a great state. I'm sorry it isn't San Francisco, but it's next best, I suppose you agree, is to be in the city of Los Angeles and under the good influences of California. I'm sure the Democrats will pick a good choice, and I, for one, of course, think the issues are pretty plain and one that we will get voter response to, much as I respect many Republicans that I know and I've worked with. I think the country will be in better hands in the next 8 years than a Democrat.
Thank you, Governor Harriman. The meeting is adjourned.
Very good. I don't want you to get away.
This is Stuart Richardson Moore, and with me today is the Honorable Averell Harriman, former governor of New York. Just a few minutes ago, Mr. Harriman spoke here before the Commonwealth Club of California at its regular Friday meeting in the Sheraton Palace Hotel of San Francisco. And his topic was peace with Russia. Governor Harriman, you said that we had a historic opportunity to seize the initiative in the struggle against communism today. You referred to the Marshall Plan, which we took the initiative 12 years ago, and its great success. You suggest if we show the same vision that we can again seize the initiative by helping the countries that need help, the so-called backward countries. You reported that when you personally interviewed Mr. Stalin many years ago, that he really expected the economic collapse of Europe. Why didn't that happen, sir?
Well, I reported at the time that from my talks with Stalin, I was quite convinced that the communists were going to try to take over Western Europe. Europe was on its knees, if you remember. UNRWA was to help feed the people, but what they needed was capital to reconstruct their factories and get the raw materials to get the wheels of industry and commerce going again. Now, we found almost immediately after the war that this was going on. I recommended we take some action as early as 1945, but it was 1947, remember, that General Marshall made his historic speech. And I'm satisfied if it hadn't been for the Marshall Plan, Stalin would have been right. Italy and France would have succumbed, and then with that, perhaps the rest of Europe. Now, of course, the countries are stronger than ever. Now our allies in trying to protect democracy all over the world. They're more prosperous than ever. The plan succeeded beyond everyone's expectations, and one of the reasons for it was a cooperative plan. We got the other countries to take the responsibility, and we were partners of theirs, and it was not a superimposed program of ours. And then, above all else, we had enough money. There's nothing I told the businessmen here today. They knew that there's the surest way to lose money, Mr. Ward, I'm sure you'll agree, is to underfinance a new development. They can guarantee that your money will be lost. It's fair to say that we had enough money to do the job, and that's one of the reasons why it succeeded. Today, the underdeveloped countries need capital. They're not getting enough of it, and they're marking time. They're increasing their populations, unfortunately, very fast, and they're not expanding their food and industrial production much more than to take care of their added population.
Well, now, this is going to take a lot of money, Governor. How about getting it?
Well, it's hard to find just what it is. I made a guesstimate, which was made by some competent people, that the underdeveloped countries were today getting about $5 billion of new capital every year. That's from all sources, private capital, American and foreign, private loans, the World Bank, government loans, even from Russia, as well as our development loan fund and also the use of our surplus food.
Now, as they used to say when we were boys, Governor, that when one boy talked strongly about how he's going to do, we'd say, spell one word, four-letter word, able. Are we able?
Well, the money involved, I was going on to say, is about $3 billion more. That again, is from all sources, and possibly the maximum that we should be expected to do with that is about half, which is about our relative strength, and $1.5 billion. When we are spending $40 billion for military, is a relatively small sum and could be taken care of in any budget, and we're not depleting the resources of this nation. Matter of fact, President Eisenhower thinks we're going to expand by $30 or $40 billion next year, and so it's even a small percentage of the additional taxes which he expects to levy out of existing tax rates.
Governor Harriman, you referred to a fair share for the United States in your talk today. How would you define what is a fair share for the United States to carry, sir?
Well, it's very hard to say that. That's a matter of cooperation with countries. We, fortunately, as a dividend of the Marshall Plan, we now have countries that can contribute instead of being a deficit. But we must recognize that the European countries' standard of living is way below ours. Britain is the top, only about 50% of ours. Germany, prosperous as she is, her standard of living in monetary value is only about 40%. Japan, as you well know, is less than 15%. But another way to gauge the prosperity of these countries is to take automobiles. You know, the last figures the United Nations gives is 1957, and we had over 300 automobiles per 1,000 in our country, whereas Great Britain had 84, and Western Germany only 52. And in refrigerators, we had 96 to every 100 dwelling unit that had electricity, whereas the British and the Germans only about 12. So that you can see their standard of living is below ours, and therefore on a per capita basis, we can't expect them to do as much. But if you I've found in dealing with the Western European countries, if you approach them in a spirit of cooperation and not one of dictation, that way you can get them to hold up their own end, and they take pride in holding up their end. And incidentally, their own trade is expanded if they finance some of their exports, which makes it possible for them to develop their future trade relations with these countries.
Well, Governor Harriman, you referred to the fact that Russia would be invited to come in on this plan that you have in mind, in the same way she was invited to come in on the Marshall Plan. What would the result be if Russia should decline? We remember that one of the satellite nations at least accepted the Marshall Plan and then heard from Moscow apparently and backed out and declined. What would you envision?
Well, you remember both Poland and Czechoslovakia both wanted to join, and they were very much shocked when they weren't permitted to join. Now, I doubt if Russia will join, but if she does, it'll mean that she'll bear her share of the load, and if she doesn't, I think her imperialist motives will be exposed, and I think it'll do her a lot of propaganda damage in the minds of the people.
Governor Harriman, this is your fourth talk before the Commonwealth Club of California, and one of our mutual late friends, Dr. Henry F. Grady, former Assistant Secretary of State, first told the club years ago that the New Deal was on for India, and you took India as your central example of needs for this year. What was it you told us about this country with its 400 million population?
Well, I went there last winter believing that India is a key. It's a key for a number of reasons, both, you know, as standing between Southeast Asia and Africa, but also a key because she's the largest country, free country in the world in terms of population, and the eastern peoples are watching how China develops and improves their industrial production, a standard of living for the people. And if India doesn't keep pace or do a job that is satisfactory to the people, why, there'll be a tendency to look to the communist methods. Now, I studied the situation. I became quite impressed with the competence of the Indian government. They inherited, you know, a public service from the British. They've got experienced people, more so than other countries in some of the other countries in Eastern Europe, Eastern Asia. And they've figured out a five-year plan, which Mr. Nehru believes will put them on their feet. Now, the economists today tell us that if these underdeveloped countries can break through the barrier of cycle of poverty and get to a self-generating economy, they can stand on their own feet. In other words, can get capital in the future through normal sources of finance. And if we give them we see that they get, not from us, about $1 billion a year. That's only about $2.50 per capita. It's not a big sum. For 5 years, we can see the results, and I believe we'll be very much satisfied with it. Now, of that today, perhaps they're only getting about half that amount, and the increase is not a staggering sum in terms of what is at stake. India has about over a third of all of the peoples of the underdeveloped countries, and as I say, is kind of a land, is kind of a gauge. And we can be confident there's a lot of misunderstanding about Mr. Nehru. He won't form any military alliances with us, or hasn't been willing to so far, but he is as dedicated to the principle of human dignity and freedom and independence as any statesman in the world.
Governor Harriman, you said that one of our guides was that the people, undeveloped nations, did not want what you called handouts, but they wanted loans, food, and so forth. We're all familiar with the old saying, I had my money and my friend. I loaned my money to my friend. I lost my money and my friend. Now, if we keep on giving these loans on a however high a level, indefinitely, what would you envisage for the future, Governor?
Well, I think it ought to be done on an international basis. That's what I proposed in my speech. There ought to be multilateral arrangements made, either through the United Nations or on a regional basis. And we found, you know, in the World Bank, that the countries don't resent conditions placed by a banker who is dispassionate, do resent conditions placed by one nation. They think it's interference in their internal affairs. I think we ought to drop this idea of trying to buy friends, buy loans. As you say, it's the surest way to make enemies. Now, I wouldn't say make enemies, but to get into trouble with people.
Gratitude is a lively anticipation of future
favors. That's rather cynical. But what we're after is the results, not gratitude. We're after good, healthy partners in the free world. Healthy in the sense they'll become greater trading partners, buy more of our stuff and add to our prosperity, produce more of the things we need from them, and above all else, man the frontiers of freedom.
Governor Harriman, until very recently, in one of our biggest hotels here, they prominently displayed postcards showing Uncle Joe Stalin with a nice pipe and a benign expression. In your discussion today, based on your very personal experiences, Mr. Stalin, over the years in Russia and Moscow, you painted him as sort of a Boris Karloff, did you not?
Yes, he was a tough man. He was extremely able. He was the man that developed all of this program, which we're now finding, the scientific program as well as the economic development. He told me much about it when I was ambassador, and I had great respect for his abilities, but he ruled by fear. He was afraid of the people, and the people were afraid of him. And even Mr. Khrushchev told me that, as I said to the group today, that in the last days of his life, Stalin got more and more suspicious, and when they were called to see Stalin, they never knew whether they were going to see their families again. Can you imagine that? Now, Khrushchev was determined, and his present group there, to have a sense of security themselves, and so they've demoted the secret police, still further, you notice in the papers recently, and they are now ruling through the Communist Party and through the Central Committee, which is the Central Committee of this boss-ridden country.
Mr. Harriman, you referred to Khrushchev as a consummate actor in your talk to the Commonwealth Club today. How would you size up his reaction to the trip in which he incidentally spoke to the Commonwealth Club here in this very hotel?
Well, I think he learned something. He learned something about the American standard of living. He came to my house, you know, and I think the businessmen there told him, as I asked them to, that we were not dependent upon war business for our prosperity. We'd be better off if we could reduce our armaments. But I think the important thing about Khrushchev's trip here is what he did when he went home. You know, he boasted about the fact that he had been a great success over here. He'd relieved tensions, and he was getting along well with President Eisenhower. They could expect peace. Now, the Russian people want peace as much as anybody in the world. They've suffered very greatly, and they're afraid of us. They're afraid, it's unbelievable to think, but they've been brainwashed to think that we might be the aggressor nation. So he's got peace on his political slogan, and he's also, I think, due to what he saw here, he's promised him more consumer goods. So he has a political slogan to get the goodwill of the Russian people and the Communist Party, which I think he's dependent upon for hold his job. Peace and prosperity, that has a kind of a, they laughed when I said that here, that had a kind of a familiar ring to some of the Republicans around here. And I suggested that they might be a little careful, or else some people would point out that the Republican slogan was just like Russian Khrushchev slogan, and I didn't know they'd like that. So
we thought perhaps you were referring to the old slogan of McKinley's campaign, two chickens in every pot, wasn't it? Now, the mayor of Los Angeles made some remark to Mr. Khrushchev.
That was two automobiles in every garage. You remember that?
That's been modernized. Two automobiles in every garage.
Well, another president. I won't mention.
All right. Did you find Mr. K's psychological approach to campaigning a little bit similar?
Well, I think he wants to get along with people. He also believes that he's got to get the spirit of the people back of his program. And the labor, although they are under very stern discipline and forced to work under conditions that our labor wouldn't like, at the same time, he is getting a better spirit among the work people than Stalin did. Of course, the whole system is obnoxious to me, but we've got to recognize their strengths and recognize the things they're doing well. And they've adopted the incentive system all the way through their economy, both in terms of rewarding their scientists, rewarding their labor, rewarding their writers, and as well as rewarding the managers that produce more than they plan.
In your concluding paragraph, perhaps, would you repeat that for us?
Well, as far as I think that the problem with us here is that peaceful coexistence is not possible. Khrushchev, in the terms that we think of peace as goodwill among nations and working together for common good. Khrushchev at the same time says we're going to be buried in the historic sense. So peaceful coexistence of Khrushchev is all-out competitive coexistence, competitive for our survival and freedom. Now, this is a challenge that we must face.
Thank you very much, Governor. And now Dr. Arthur G. Coons will be the speaker in the same station next week.